I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Before I begin the show, let me remind you all that this Saturday night at the Cradle Alliance, there will be a benefit for Equality Maryland, a group that works to eliminate discrimination against lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender individuals. Performances will include Leah Gilmore, Jason Dove, and many others, and you can go to equalitymaryland.org. To find out more information about that. We'll do a bit more of that later in the week. Right now, before in our first part of our program, we're going to be talking once again with Charles Blow, who is the visual op-ed columnist for New York Times. Charles, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be back.
Glad to hear your voice. Number is 410-319-8888. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. When I read your column on Saturday in the New York Times, it's really needed to see if we can get you back on the air with us for a little bit of time here. I think what you wrote was pretty poignant. Let's, for those who have not read the Times, you can see it up on our website or go to the New York Times website. But the idea that you kind of, as you put it, all these folks were on the mall, all the African-Americans in the mall, cooing Obama about the future and being hopeful. But then you had to shake us in reality when you heard what Representative James Clyburn of South Carolina said, the majority whip, every child has lost every excuse. And that's where you kind of get off the train for a minute.
Exactly. I think, you know, the motivation there is a noble one, which is to say that this is an inspirational moment that Barack Obama gives hope to a lot of children who thought that there may not have been hope. But there's a difference. You know, hope can be helpful. It is this hyperbole that I feel like is harmful because it plays into the American mythology that you can be anything that you want to be irrespective of environmental influences. And I think that that's where it becomes harmful. I think that, you know, your own personal drive and desires are one component of a very large and complicated mosaic factors that lead to success in life, and that includes, you know, how your parents behave, how they treat you, how motivated they are, enthusiastic about learning and protecting you and keeping you safe. That includes whether or not your school provides a nurturing environment that you know allows you to learn. It's not a failing school. That includes whether or not your community is a safe place for you to live and exist. That includes whether or not, you know, the policies that are in place help to facilitate better programs for you, your parents, your school, your community. And all of that has a very big psychological and realistic, you know, kind of tangible pull on what you will, what you will be in your life.
And this that you always do is pull out these glaring statistics and that you make us kind of all stop and think about. And I think they're pretty glaring. I mean, when you talk about the child trends, that 70% of all black children are born to single mothers, but that 60% of all black children live in low-income families and a third in poor families. And I went to the website that you cited, National Center for Children in Poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of how, I mean, just the whole notion of, let's say, how we define poverty in America and who lives in it.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me that what you made me think about, and maybe you can talk to us just for a minute, Charles, is how we define the notion of poverty in America.
Well, what they were doing is they were using about, you know, I'm not looking at those stats now, but I think it was about $18,000 to $20,000 below that line was poor.
Right.
And less than twice that amount for
right.
a family was low income.
And
I think that people kind of miss this idea, you know, that there's so many poor people living in America, and it's easy to look over because you see so many statistics of gains, but you kind of get those at the upper end of the spectrum, and it moves the average needle. But there's still tons and tons of people who live in poverty in America.
And the idea, I think, it was really, when I looked at the statistics about how many children are actually living in poverty here when you are in low-income families, and that 42 to 44% of all children in America under the age of 6 years old live in low-income families.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a pretty glaring statistic.
It's amazing. And as it relates to this particular column, you think about what that means in terms of providing opportunities for children. That means that kid is less likely to be able to afford health insurance. That kid is less likely to be able to afford any sort of private after-school care. That kid is less likely to be able to afford any kind of tutoring if they're struggling in school. They're less likely to be able to see a counselor if they have a behavioral disorder or to afford that medication. They're less likely to be able to relocate from a dangerous neighborhood to a more safe neighborhood. You know, it really, when you think about the implications of poverty and low income status on children, it's a big deal.
And I think now when you're watching these budget cuts going on around state governments, whether it's New York or Maryland or California, wherever you may be,
mm-hmm.
and those cuts always fall on the back of kids, it seems to me, from the analysis, that a lot of the cuts fall on the backs of children.
Absolutely. The situation that we have now is likely to get much worse in the near future. Right here in New York City, we've had budget cuts, and so the school board is looking at cutting back on tutoring and after-school programs. The city has announced that it will no longer finance the city-financed daycare programs. All of these kind of, they're minor support programs, but they're essential to people who are barely making it. And if you see that, that's the first kind of wave of cuts, because education is a big portion of any state and city budget. So that's the first place they look for kind of budget cutting. And that's a problem for these kids.
So I wonder when you put these columns together, and your own motivation for putting these columns together, for your own motivation for putting it in front of the 1.1 million people who read the New York Times, the 20 million people who might breeze through the website of New York Times and pick the piece up you wrote. I mean, you're talking to a fairly affluent, large audience. What are you saying to them? What are you trying to make them think about?
Well, I'm fascinated by the kind of sociological part of our society, why we think what we think, why we are sometimes wrong in what we believe about the world. Why we don't quite understand the phenomena that are happening right around us to our neighbors. And sometimes we don't even understand how we come to believe what we believe internally. And so it's almost like a mission for me to shine a light on these kinds of situations. I feel like a lot of people just don't get it. People want to believe. We all want. I want to believe that you can be whatever you want to be. But somebody has to shine a light at that and say, you know, not necessarily, and this is why. And just take a sober look at that using statistics which is what I do. And I find it just very gratifying just to always be presenting people with the facts.
And you do lay them out. That's one of the things I love about your column. I look forward to it every time of the week when you put it out.
We're talking,
by the way, with Charles Blow, who is a columnist for the New York Times, the visual op-ed columnist. You find him every other Saturday, right, Charles?
Exactly.
Right, every other Saturday in the New York Times. And he usually throws both charts and glaring stats at us to make us think about our presumptions. And you can talk about that with us for the next part of this program at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Later in the program, we'll be talking to folks in the Maryland Association of Court-Appointed Special Advocates who live in the middle of what Charles Blow is talking about. But right now, join us here at 410-319-8888. And you take this Malcolm Gladwell quote out of an article, an interview he had in New York Magazine. And I just want to read the quote, and let's talk about your sense of this quote.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote is, "I am explicitly turning my back on, I think, these kind of empty models that say, you know, you can be whatever you want to be. Well, actually, you can't be whatever you want to be. The world decides what you can and can't be."
Right.
I like kind of just for you, I actually pulled that out of the article. It clearly meant something to you.
Right. I mean, I think that the best way to look at that is to take two examples. You take one example. Take a kid, and he's a middle of the road kid. He's not a straight A student. He's a boy who, you know, as they say, boys will be boys. He shows out a little bit. He gets in trouble a little bit, and then you try to figure out what that kid will be later in life. For many white kids, they are in a cocoon of success. This is kind of like this idea that Gladwell talks about. Everything in their life points them into a successful direction. Some would say that's why Bush could be president. you have two parents, you have economic means, not necessarily wealthy, but just economic means. You have parents who are engaged in your life, engaged in your education. You go to better schools. You have role models that provide a blueprint for you to know, you know, how to behave as adults. You almost have to try hard to fail. You take that same kid and change his color to black, and many of those kids are born to a single mother. She's barely making it. He does not have economic means. He lives in a very kind of violent neighborhood in some cases. There's quite a bit of psychological, emotional abuse. There's a lot of schools in the inner cities are failing schools. You add up all those ingredients, and that kid has to try very hard to succeed. They're coming from such vastly different points of view, and I think this is what Gladwell's getting at, that there's all these other factors around you. It's not just what you want from life, because you talk to any 3-, 4-, 5-year-old kid, mm-hmm. they all want to be special. They all want to grow up and be something amazing. It's just the things that happen along the path of their life direct them in a way that doesn't necessarily help them to fulfill those dreams.
I, as I was reading your piece, and I really kind of went back and I read Gladwell's article, and I went to some of the sites that you looked at when you were talking about the statue talking about. Before I get there, I mean, one of the things I think is important you also point out is that many kids have come to this, but you also write that how many of these kids rise above those circumstances.
Right.
And work hard to do that. But
exactly.
When I was going through the background, so the places you went to research your article, and the family of four making $21,000 a year is considered in a poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
But that in the 1960s, we based that on the cost of food and not on the cost of transportation, cost of housing, so that, as they wrote here, that the current federal poverty level equals about 29% of the median household income, but in the 60s, using the same model, it would be over 50% nearly 50% of that medium. And I mean, we just don't seem to get our hands around how many people live so close to the edge, we have to kind of create a discussion where maybe we have to redefine what it means to be in poverty in America.
It's a very fluid thing. That number doesn't change as often as the factors that affect the changes. For instance, in the last couple of years, you've seen a skyrocketing in the price of food. Well, that number hasn't changed to reflect that
right.
change in the price of food. This past summer, we had $4 a gallon gas prices. Well, that meant that a lot of people had to then make a decision about whether or not, you know, do they buy enough food, or do they buy enough clothes, or do they buy enough gas to get to work? And people who live on these margins, when there's a tiny flux for us that's kind of aggravating, and we don't want to pay $4 a gallon for gas, but we can afford to do so, they have to make real choices. And it really affects the bottom line for those families that are most at risk. And I think that when we think about, you know, numbers of people in poverty, we have to think about that as kind of a round number, because there's no way, there are people dipping in and out of it all the time around those margins.
We're talking with Charles Blow, who is the visual op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and about his column this last Saturday, No More Excuses, where he talks about all the black folks that came to the mall and cheering instead of everybody else, Obama becoming president. But then talking about the issue of poverty is in the black community and poverty is in non-white communities in America, and saying basically just hold the phone a minute. Let's talk about what is going on in America and what we have to do here. And as he closes the article, I think it's something for us to ponder. We're going to open the phones here. When he says President Obama is a potent symbol, he's no panacea. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let's go to the phones as we talk with Charles Blow, New York Times columnist, and Halim. You're on the air.
Yes, how y'all doing?
Well, Halim.
I'm good.
All right. My perspective on the situation, I believe that the way that we traditionally have approached the problem in the inner city African-American community has perpetuated the problem, and that is the focus on assistance to the women and children and a neglect of development of the males. So you have males impregnating females, and they're not qualified to be fathers. And because we haven't put an emphasis on the development of these guys, you know, and they, in their soul, they know that they're not qualified. Instead of being what they are supposed to be, they run from the situation. I think if our culture was to put emphasis on the development of the males, I think we would have a situation where we wouldn't have poverty being recycled. We would have more prosperity because the fathers would be present in the home. They wouldn't run as the tendency amongst so many of them is to run. I was raised without my father, and so many of my brothers and, you know, children in my inner circle, the same thing. So, you know, it's to me, it's the way that the society has approached the situation, just given the assistance to the females and the neglect of the males, and then the African-American culture following that same premise or the same paradigm and not putting emphasis on the development of the males, will prefer to criticize them and put them down. You know, I think that's the big problem.
Halim, thank you so much. Charles, you want to say anything to that before we hit another call here and take a break?
Well, I think he makes two interesting points, but I would kind of disagree with him on probably on both of them. One is that the absence of fathers in the kids of most African American children is a huge problem and a big factor in the number of kids who fail in one way or another. It means that there's one income, which is a big deal. If you look at statistics, I've quoted these statistics in a previous column, black women are the least likely to get the full child support that they are due from the fathers and the most likely to get absolutely no child support whatsoever. Black children are the most likely not to ever see their fathers at all. And that's a problem. But that is not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily mean that the government is responsible for telling you to stand up and take care of your kids. You know, that's a very simple solution that has nothing to do with policy. That just says, when it comes to your time and your money, put your kids first.
Charles Blow, I know you have to run. I do appreciate you once again joining us. It's always a pleasure to read your columns and keep jarring us and making us think. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Charles Blow, visual op-ed columnist for the New York Times. His column is every other Saturday in the New York Times. When we take a short break here, we're going to come back and meet Ed Kilcullen, State Director for the Maryland Association of Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and Charles Harris, who's in the studio with me now, who's a volunteer at Maryland CASA, putting their lives to work for our children. We'll find out more about that when we return. And I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. Over 70 years later, they're still there helping people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner, welcome back. Earlier we were talking with Charles Blow, the visual op-ed columnist for the New York Times. who always throws these statistics out about our society pretty glaringly and makes us all kind of think about, at least those who read his column, what we face here in America, and just looking at the dry, cold, hard statistics and turning them human in some ways. But we're going to turn them human one step more right now. We've had folks on from CASA on my show a while back, about a year ago, and they're back with us today. And it is a very unique and interesting, challenging program that intervenes in the lives of children in our communities who have some of the deepest challenges that anyone faces, that very few people intervene in the middle of, to protect them and to protect our future in general. Well, this hour, we're going to talk for the rest of the hour with Ed Kilcullen, who is the State Director for the Maryland Association of Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and Charles Harris, who spent 40 years in the Social Security Administration. And during that time, he and his wife were both volunteers for CASA, and in their retirement continue to do so. And Ed Kilcullen and Charles Harris, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. I'll write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let's set this up, Ed, for many people who maybe to this point do not even know what CASA means, being a court-appointed special advocate is.
Okay. We are volunteers who are appointed by the court. We're appointed to cases of children who've been under the protection of the courts because of abuse or neglect. And those volunteers are appointed by the judge to really go out and gather the information that the judge would gather on his own if he or she had the time to do that. So the volunteers are appointed generally to one child at a time, and they go out and they interview the child, the child's biological family, foster family, teachers, therapists, counselors, so on, and then make a report back to the court with recommendations as to what's in the child's best interest.
Now, who are these kids? Why are they in the court in the first place?
All of the children are victims of abuse and neglect. They've been determined by the court to be what's called a child in need of assistance. And so there's been a finding of abuse and neglect. Most of the children we work with have been removed from their homes and are in foster homes or residential treatment group homes, et cetera.
Now, how many children are we talking about in the state of Maryland who would fall into this category?
There are between 10,000 and 11,000 children in foster care today. We serve...
As a result of child abuse?
As a result of child abuse, right.
And how many of these kids do you serve of those 11,000, 12,000?
We serve about 1,300 children a year. So we're only serving, on any given day, we're serving about 10% of the children in care.
So the kids who get the service from CASA, how is their life different than the ones who don't?
Well, there have been some studies done. We are a national program, so there have been studies done across the country that show that children who have a CASA volunteer appointed to them have fewer placements, fewer disruptions in placements. So rather than going from one foster home to another, the volunteer often can intervene and make that transition a positive one, so that it's not a disruptive one. So it's not one that lasts only a couple weeks and then the child moves to another placement. Our goal is to get them out of foster care and into permanent homes as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, because we're so few in number in terms of our volunteer pool, we get assigned to the most difficult cases. So often those are kids who have been in the system for a long time. There are multiple problems and lots of family challenges that take longer to resolve. So while our goal is to get them out of foster care in a shorter time than the average, because of the complexity of the cases we're assigned to, it's not an apples and oranges comparison.
So, Charles Harris, I'm curious, here we are in the middle of the beginning of the presidency of Barack Obama, and one of the things he has made one of his clarion calls is to become a volunteer. But you've been following that call before President Obama became President Obama, and I'm curious. I mean, what takes? Do you have children of your own?
Yes, I do.
So you have kids of your own?
Yes, I have 3 adult kids, and I have 2 other kids that I adopted. One of them is 20, and the other is 15.
So that's interesting. So, and you and your wife, though, have been doing this work with CASA, volunteering with kids who are really in trouble, for a long time.
Yes.
So tell us about that. Why did you... why was somebody working full-time through the Social Security Administration, raising all these children yourself, you and your wife, full-time job, takes up a lot of time, do this?
Well, actually,
become a volunteer.
Actually, it goes a little further back than that.
Okay.
Because my wife and I, we both started working with advocating for at-risk kids when we were in the military. They had a program in the military where we worked with kids from Baltimore City who were at risk. We would work with them on the weekends and then during the summer. So that was back in the 80s. So after we got out of the military, we started working with foster kids.
You were both in the military? Both you and your wife were
both
in? Yes,
my wife and I both were in the military.
What were you in?
Oh, we were in the National Guard. I retired from the Army National Guard.
Uh-huh.
And my wife, she was in for about 12 years. And actually, when we got out of the military, we started working with foster kids, and we started really seeing the need of somebody to somewhat make recommendations for some of these kids because they weren't getting their needs met. And see, when you're involved with the foster care system, you get to see firsthand how a lot of kids are just falling through the cracks.
So now, I'm also just curious, though, in terms of your own personal life, where we get into the lives of these children, I think this is really very interesting that somebody who is raising, sounds like, five children altogether that you had, two adopted, three were born to you and your wife.
Yes.
But you take this extra time of the kids.
Well, my three biological kids are all adults, all self-sufficient, married. My oldest son is a colonel in the Army right now, and actually, we've just been committed to trying to do what we could to help some of these other kids because we were so blessed with our own kids. None of them had to go through the kind of trials that these kids in the system go through. So we wanted to see what we could do to give some of these other children a chance.
And I wonder, Ed Kilcullen, if we could talk a bit about what these advocates do. I mean, in terms of, I mean, you think of this as a professional job, somebody who's going to work with a kid who are children who have been sexually and physically abused by their parents, that it would take quite a lot to work with young people in that situation.
Yeah, we provide pretty extensive training. Our volunteers do not substitute for a social worker or an attorney or any other professional involved in the child's life. And that's really the beauty about CASA is we bring in people from all walks of life, various backgrounds, educational levels, and so on. And they really have a fresh perspective. And again, they're only appointed to one child at a time or a small sibling group. And so they can really focus all of their attention, 100% of their volunteer time, on that child or group of children. And that's, you know, a unique perspective that a caseworker who has 30 children may not have the luxury of having. Sometimes attorneys meet the child for the first time 5 minutes before they go into a court hearing, and they're huddled in the corner of the waiting room outside the courtroom saying, you know, okay, what do you want? What do you want me to say in there? And our volunteers have that luxury of time where they can really get to know the child and get a sense of what's in the child's best interest.
But what do they do? I mean, if you're advocating for this child, and the parents have been brought to court because they've abused their child, then what exactly does the volunteer do? How do they intervene?
The volunteer meets with the child, meets with the social worker, you know, gathers some background on the child's case. Talks with the biological parents, talks with the foster parents, teachers, and so on, and gets a sense of how the child's doing, what kinds of services the child needs, if the child is in school, is he or she getting the educational services that he or she needs, you know, all those kinds of things. The volunteer is really focusing on what that individual child needs, and then any gaps are reported, you know, to the court, to the social worker, so that those gaps can be filled.
So, Charles, can you give us an example of some of the kind of things you've had to face? You don't have to give kids' names, obviously, or families, but give us some of the real-life stories that you've had to deal with here.
Okay, well, one of the more recent situations that we had to work with was it was a family where it was a single mom. She had four young kids, and they hadn't been removed yet, but the Department of Social Services was in the midst of trying to decide whether or not they needed to be removed because of neglect, and mostly neglect in their situation. And actually, when we were first assigned the case, and see, we actually go in and meet with the kids where they are, in their home or foster homes or group homes or wherever. And when we first went there, we found that it was a situation where it was the young lady and all four of her boys were sleeping in a small room the size of a closet. It didn't have any ventilation, no windows or anything. They were all sleeping on a mattress on the floor.
And where was this? In an apartment or?
It was in a house.
Uh-huh.
But they all had just this one room
mm-hmm.
in the house. And they were staying in the home of a relative.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the home was in really bad condition, and it wasn't really safe for the kids. So we were able to make recommendations to the Department of Social Services to have the kids moved out of the room and moved into a room with proper ventilation. And we also got the Department of Social Services to get beds for the kids. And one of them was an infant. They got a crib for the infant. And we also got the mom into parenting classes and we got other resources for her.
Well, had the mother been accused of abuse, or just was abuse because the children were neglected because they weren't cared for in a proper place? How did that?
It was a situation mostly of neglect and abandonment, because the mom was spending days at a time out of the home, and the kids were just being left with her relatives. So the relatives had to work. They couldn't really take care of the kids properly. So we actually were able to get the mom to get a little part-time job, and she started staying home, and she got into the parenting program. She started doing really well. And matter of fact, we just talked to her recently, and she's still progressing.
So tell me about this story. I mean, from your perspective, Ed Kilcullen, I mean, that, and how, what this story says to you in terms of the commonplace nature of the kind of work that you see every day.
I mean, it's a beautiful story for me to hear, because it's a family that was not, the children were not taken from the home. We were able to intervene early enough, prevent a disruption in that placement, and provide some services. Mom, got support and got the parenting classes and was helped to get a part-time job. I mean, that's what we want. And those children did not face the trauma of being removed from their home. So ideally, we would love to get involved that early in a case. Often we don't, because of the nature and the limited number of volunteers that we have. We often get assigned much later in the case.
So how would this family's case come to the attention of the courts in the beginning?
Well, there's a report of suspected abuse or neglect.
Who makes that report?
Anyone can. A neighbor can, a teacher, a relative, anyone. I mean, actually, the Maryland law requires all citizens to report any suspicion of abuse or neglect. There are mandated reporters, like a teacher, a social worker, doctors, nurses are required mm-hmm. to report any suspicion of abuse or neglect. So a report, oftentimes the reports come from schools. Kids show up without shoes on or some other sign of neglect, and that triggers a call to social services to intervene. And then social services goes out and determine whether it's a safe situation or not. This family obviously was brought in, and provided support without removing the children from the home. And fortunately, CASA was assigned early enough that they could get in and recommend some services to maintain that family.
It was seen to me at some point that sometimes if you're assigned a child from court, that you could find yourself in situations, some really confrontational situations, either with the kids or with the parents.
Well, we haven't been in any real confrontational situations with parents or kids. Sometimes when they're in foster homes, you have to build your confidence of the guardian or the foster parent, because sometimes they think when we come in, we're coming to investigate them. So we have to assure them that it's we're just there for the best interest of the child, and it's not about them. And usually the kids are very receptive to us because they know that we're there because we truly care about them, because we're not paid for what we do. They know that we're not just doing a job. We're there because we care about them.
That's I understand that, but what I'm saying is, I mean, when you have children who are in this bad shape, I mean, there must be. I mean, the volunteers can only do so much. I mean, so what are volunteers expected to do? I mean, you walk in, you have a situation where a kid is taken to. The families are brought into court because the child, let's say, has been physically abused. And I read some of those stories that you talked about where a little boy maybe had his head shaven off. His hair shaven off, and it was physically abused. So what do volunteers do in that situation? I mean, how does somebody literally intervene in that child's life?
Well, again, by talking with the professionals involved, we're obviously not going to put our volunteers in an unsafe situation.
No, I didn't mean to even suggest that. Right,
okay.
Right.
So, you know, they would get the background from the caseworker assigned to the child's case and really get an assessment of what is the situation, you know, by talking with the child, like Charles said, forming that trusting relationship with the child. So they're going to share with them, with the volunteer, what their feelings are, you know, what their sense of their situation is and what their desires are. And then it's really up to the volunteer to determine what's in that child's best interest. Many of the kids we work with are, despite, you know, coming from very difficult circumstances, want to go back to what's familiar to them. So, and that's one of the key differences with CASA. The attorney appointed to the child, and every child has an attorney appointed to them, but the attorney has to represent what the child wants. And often what the child wants is to go back home to what's familiar to them, and that's always not always in their best interest. So the volunteer is really out to represent what's in the child's best interest. And even though the child may want to go back home, we have to make an assessment of whether that home situation is safe, whether the parents are ready to accept the child back into the home or not.
And how do you determine, in terms of your job, what it means to be in the child's best interest? How do you define that?
Well, I mean, there are several different principles. I mean, safety, obviously, of the child, whether they're the circumstances that led to the child being removed, that the child has been removed from the home, whether those gaps have been filled, those services have been provided. If, you know, and that's another thing that CASA volunteers do with the luxury of time is that they can get out more often than a caseworker often can. The caseworker is mandated to make a visit every 30 days. And that happens in a good month, but the volunteers often get out there every week, every other week, so they can get there more frequently. They can see if a boyfriend who's not supposed to be in the home is there and shouldn't be, and can report that to the social worker. If this family situation has changed, the family has moved from one relative to another, and this circumstance is not acceptable for the family to be living in, they can make those reports.
We're talking about CASA, which is the Maryland Association, which is court-appointed special advocates. We're talking about the state director of the Maryland Association of Court-Appointed Special Advocates, Ed Kilcullen. Charles Harris is a volunteer with Maryland CASA. This is a program where kids, when families are sent to court for physical sexual abuse of children, neglect of children, there's a court-appointed person who can go in and intervene in that child's life, become the advocate for the child, and intervene for his or her safety. And we're talking about that program now. You can join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. In this time when President Barack Obama has made volunteerism the linchpin of what he thinks Americans should do to make our country better, I'm curious how all of you think about a program like this and how you might think about in your own lives how you volunteer in children's lives and what we have to do to intervene in children's lives. 410-319-8888. This is one example, and I think that, I mean, this is kind of an example also in many ways. It's at the extreme edge of what happens to children? And, I mean, when you make a visit, Charles, and people who are advocates, do you make a visit and announced or unannounced?
Usually we make announced visits. We don't just spring in on them by surprise. We'll contact the guardian or caretaker and let them know that we're coming. And usually when we come, we become like somewhat of a consistent person in the child's life. They get to know us, and they see us regular enough. We get opportunities to take them to neutral environments sometimes.
Can they call you if they need to?
Well, usually we'll let them have our cell phone number. We don't give them our home number. We can't take the children home with us, but we can take them
places. But you want to sometimes.
Yes, sometimes. we've met some kids that we felt like we would like to be able to take them home, but that's not something that we're allowed to do. But the joy of it all is when we can really make a difference in these children's lives, because usually my wife and I, we somewhat go the extra mile and we be there for them for birthdays. We try to provide holidays for them. We get to be really consistent in their lives.
I'm not surprised. Let's go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on volunteers and your thought in this program that takes care of our children. We're talking about court-appointed special advocates who intervene in children's lives or some of the most desperate children in our communities. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And Kara in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hello? Kara, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure. I listen every day. I'm just calling to add that I was a CASA volunteer for Baltimore City. I, too, work for Social Security. I think we had loads of volunteers from Social Security at one time. It's a wonderful program. I stopped because I went to Virginia to work. Now I'm back, and it's interesting. I told my granddaughter on Inauguration Day that I was going to volunteer and do that again and take her with me. She's 22 years old. I think they've explained the program pretty good. You get the big picture, but CASA is just kind of in the middle. Everyone involved has their agenda. Social services has their agenda because they have guidelines and goals that they have. The children are children. They want what they want. The parents have their agenda, and we are really there to develop relationships and to determine what is going to best help this child to flourish and be emotionally and physically healthy. I loved the program. I used to facilitate a parenting skills workshop as well through CASA, mm-hmm. and in conjunction with DSS. That was good, and it helped me because I started out being really angry with people who weren't treating their children well. Hmm. And the program helped me to understand that some people want to, and they just don't know how to care for their children, and we're able to help in that instance as well.
You said something very powerful, then. Kara, I'm going to impose upon you for a minute. I ask you to hold on for a second, not go away. Is that all right?
Okay.
I'm gonna bring another caller in here who's not a volunteer in CASA, but has some questions. I'd like to come back and ask you a question about what you just said and have our panelists respond to that as well. So please, you mind if I do that to you? Just hang with me for just a minute. 410-319-8888. Lynette in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Good evening.
Hi, Lynette.
I wanted to inquire about the difficulties in doing this because I was a child in the system myself, and I know as a child, you said it well when you said they just want familiarity. Sometimes it doesn't matter the harshness of the environment. They just want what they're used to. So I can imagine, and I've done work as a social worker, as a home visitor, and it's difficult trying to want something for someone that doesn't really want it for themselves. So even though you're like providing all the resources and things like that, I mean, children, you can provide the best environment, and they'll run back to what they're used to. So I can imagine that can be a very, very difficult situation. Because I just wanted you to give some more insight on that difficulty, those type of difficulties.
Lynette, real quick, before I turn to our guest to respond to you. I mean, so you were saying you were one of those children who was in foster care?
Yes, I was. And if I knew them what I know now, and I have a child that's 12-year-old, 13-year-old that I'm going through those difficulties with. It's not to the depth of abuse, but I was in a situation, and I remember at that time, it was almost like a game. You know, just like, oh, well, this is just, I didn't understand the seriousness of life. So even though those people wanted the best for me, I didn't really want the best for myself because I didn't know what the best was.
I mean, this is a very powerful point, and I'm going to go back to Kara, but what Lynette was just saying is that the children themselves, I mean, desperately want to be with the mother or father, no matter how abusive the situation is, because that's just the nature of life. And I think that sometimes systems may even go too far to try to keep families together when the child's in a dangerous situation. So respond to what Lynette was saying. Why don't we start with Ed and then go over to Charles?
I think one of the exactly what she said, that children want to go back to what's familiar to them. Often children don't know anything different. And so the home environment they grew up in is what they think every home environment is like. So when in the case where they're removed and they're placed in a foster home, they see a different situation, hopefully a much safer, more stable environment. And really it's the volunteer's job to right from the start say, my job is to determine what's best for you and not necessarily, you know, I might disagree with what you want, but my job is to really determine what's best for you and recommend that to the judge. So, you know, again, if they're upfront with them, and Charles can probably speak to this more specifically, but our job is not just to be their friend and to go in and say whatever the child wants when we go in and make our recommendation to the court. Oftentimes, it's not what the child wants because what they want may not be what's in their best interest.
So, I mean, so Charles, so what's your role in that? I mean, you have Lynette was just telling her story of being a child who was once in that situation. And how you kind of approach a child, you know, maybe I know you want to be with your mom and dad, but you just can't be. I mean, that's the position you're in.
Yes, well, we're there basically to make recommendations for the best interests of the child, even though it may not be what the child wants. It may not be exactly what the biological family wants, but we have to make sure that they have safe placement, that their needs are being met. And as far as what happens once our case is resolved, well, we stay with the case until it's resolved, until the child is in a permanent or somewhat permanent placement. And after the case is resolved, we have no authority over which way the child decides to go after that. Now, we usually try to stay in contact with the family to somewhat offer support on the side, but once the case is closed and all, and a lot of these kids, they desire to be back with their biological family, no matter how much they went through abuse or neglect. It's that natural instinct to want to be with their biological family, and that's something that we cannot change.
We're talking about CASA, the court-appointed special advocates who intervene in the lives of children who suffer abuse, neglect, sexual and physical abuse and neglect, and the courts deem that they have to either leave the home or the courts have to intervene, and these volunteers who are trained volunteers as advocates for children are assigned to individual kids. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Carol, let me ask those questions and bring you back in for a minute. I think it's really important what you said earlier about having been a volunteer, and your first reaction, your sense was to really dislike and be angry with the parents who are being accused of neglect or abuse. And I'd like you to talk a bit about that part of your sensibility and how that changed.
Well, just as I said, I was angry. As all of us, I'm sure we do, we get angry when we hear these stories about these children being mistreated by adults and people who are responsible for them. And I would just be angry, like, how can they do this? They don't need to have children, on and on and on. However, when I became a facilitator for the Parenting Skills Workshop, like the reunification program that social services sets up for most of these families require the parents to attend parenting skills workshops. When I became a facilitator for that, and because of that, you also be, you interact and you develop relationships. And then I came to understand that there are parents who indeed want to love and care properly for their children, mm-hmm. but they don't have a clue. They didn't have my father, my mother. They didn't have your mom and dad. They don't have a clue at what to do. And then once again, as we know, many of them are in positions where they are under many life pressures, and they also don't know how to handle that. Many of them are young and they're immature. So I just came to be more empathetic, not so judgmental, not so angry, not so high and mighty, but understanding in that manner. And that helped me to work with them. And what I found out, the parenting skill workshops were usually 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And parents came, and they had attitudes sometimes. They didn't want to do that. They were just coming because these people said, well,
did we just lose Kara? All right, Kara, if you can call back, we'll get you back on. I want you to finish your thought there.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, yeah, finish your thought. We'll go to the next caller.
Oh, okay. And so they were there with those attitudes, but they came to soften as well. And many of them saw in 12 weeks that there could be a change in how they related to their children, and they really didn't want to stop. But our program stopped at that point. They needed some more mentoring, family mentoring beyond that point.
And the program, so that is one of our problems, is we got to keep this thing going on, and these programs don't have enough money. Kara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for calling. Bye-bye. And one of the things we'll be talking to Governor O'Malley and others in the course of these next couple months is, with all the budget cuts, why is it always the children's programs that get cut? That's what I want to talk to them about. 410-319-8888. Joe in Howard County, who's a foster parent, is on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
You know, sorry about that.
That's right.
This is kind of an emotional situation with me y'all are talking about. With I had two children, and they were in a situation where there was heroin and cocaine, and I was able to get the children because the mother wanted to go to rehab. But after 2 years of rehab, she took me back to court to get the children. Now, I have three other children in my home. During the course of this, I found out that my oldest son had molested two of my children. And at that time, during this pain for me, I got the children. I found out what was happening. I had the child arrested and put into a safe place with my family member. And then the mother got well again and took me back to court. And I had social services, 2 years of therapy under our belt with me and my wife and my children. And just after 17 months in Howard County, a master, because I didn't have a proper lawyer, and she had a better lawyer than I did and did everything by the books right, she was giving these children back just after 17 months of being clean from heroin and shooting cocaine when she had spent most of her life being addicted to it. And these are the things that she, you know, now she gets, the one son has to stay with my family member, and she gets custody of this child. And I've been excluded from his life because his mother has full custody. As he still goes to therapy for his sexual abuse and gets well with that. But my daughter, I got to look at every night until the summertime when the master gave that child back to her mother, where she's going to Hagerstown to be with her mother that I'm afraid is going to fall off the wagon or screw
right.
up again. And the mother, they won't be honest
so-
with the
So, Joe, I mean, I like to, we only have a couple of steps, but I'd like to know what are you suggesting happens?
Well, it's just, you know, the child having to, they do a job, but they don't go to court for you. You know, when you ask them to go to court, they say, well, we don't want to get involved unless the court involves them. I mean, the volunteer thing is one, but not to stand by the parents that are doing the right thing and going to and showing that they've done a good job.
Let me ask you, Colin, if you'll just kind of respond to what he's hearing here. Ed?
Well, I think that's, you know, one of the, I don't know if CASA was involved in this case or not, but I think that's one of the great things about CASA is that they are not, I think Kara mentioned actually that, you know, we're an independent resource. We are not someone who is bound by the laws and the regulations and policies that some of the agencies that are involved are bound by. And so, you know, the agency, the Department of Social Services, is really mandated to reunite that family, that biological family, as the first option. And unless that's really impossible to happen, then they look at other resources, relatives and so on. The CASA volunteer is not bound by those policies and regulations, so we can go in and make that recommendations. If in this situation, and again, we don't, and I'm not familiar with this case, but just kind of hypothetically, if one of our volunteers were assigned to that case and really felt like the child was acclimated to this foster family and really it was in their best interest to stay with the foster family as opposed to being shuffled back and forth between biological mom and the foster family, then that would be our recommendation. So we're not bound by the Maryland law that requires that the social worker, you know, if that mother has gotten clean and it has a safe home, then the child should go back to her.
Listening to what Joe was saying, and well, let me forward to that, but very quickly, Charles. I mean, does this situation sound familiar to you?
Oh, yes, very much. Now, we can actually be the ones to make decisions in cases like this, but we do have the opportunity to interact with the attorneys that are involved. And most of the time when we make recommendations to these attorneys, they take them seriously because they know that we have done the groundwork, we've gotten to know the situation, know the child, and we know the environment. So they really consider our recommendations. So this is about the best we can do because we're not the ones who can actually make the decisions in the case. We can only make recommendations.
I mean, I think this is the work you do is incredible. I think it also just points out kind of the lack of resources that systems have to take care of children that are in need, and that I mean that's the crying shame why you're doing the kind of shining example of what could be done with more resources. And to that effect, let me just say that we can give you your website before we go, Ed. That there will be a fundraiser for CASA at the Joseph Meyerhoff Symphony Hall at 3 p.m. Sunday, February the 15th. Maren Alsop, the conductor, of course, and TAP trailblazer Savion Glover will collaborate with the BSO to raise money for CASA. And what's the website?
The CASA of Baltimore is www.casabalt.org.
Right.
And we'll put this on our website so you can find out more about that as well. And I want to thank both Ed Kilcullen, State Director for the Maryland Association of Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and the Special Advocate himself, Charles Harris, for joining us. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And our partner here is also Urbanite Magazine, available at over 800 locations at urbanite.baltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zach Coleman. Our intern today was Christina Arison. Theme music by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.